Welcome to this month's City Talks, where we'll be discussing the data revolution and its relevance to and the impact on cities. The rise of the digital technology has allowed for the collection and processing of ever greater quantities of information. The promise of this data revolution is an enhanced understanding of what people want and how they behave based on purely quantitative evidence, which might, will, have big implications for how we plan infrastructure and deliver public services in cities, both today but certainly tomorrow. This prospect has been allied to the idea that there is no one best way to use the data that is collected. Exponents of open data and big data argue that making the information collected by big institutions available to everyone is beneficial. It's not only a way to keep such institutions accountable, but it allows for a wider pool of active citizens to discover new things and build new applications that make cities work better. But is this vision of a more rationally administered city feasible or even desirable? If the availability of data is a public good, why are some nervous about putting it out in the open? And what are some of the barriers to harnessing this revolution? Joining me to discuss these questions, I have Tom Forth, Associate of the Open Data Institute in Leeds, and Doug McLeod, Director of Socrata. So before we get into the detail, we need to set up what we mean when we're talking about open data and big data. So Doug, let's start with you. What do the terms big data and open data mean to you? How do we define them, and are they the same thing?
Well, thanks, Andrew, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. No, they're very different things, and I'll focus our conversation this morning on open data, but I will help you differentiate a little bit with big data. So I think open data and the open data movement really have grown around the need for cities to be more operationally efficient, to improve the quality of service that they deliver to their residents, to increase the engagement with residents and allow residents to be more closely involved and more interested in the operation and outputs of cities, and to be more transparent in how they work. And so open data is any data that will do that. And that can be data that comes from hundreds of sources across even a moderate-sized city in the UK. Is data that is not personal and not confidential, but can be used somehow to improve efficiency, service quality delivery, or citizen engagement. And really that's open data. And that can't be confused with big data, which generally is machine-generated. Open data is often entered by people. It can be machine-generated, but big data is exponentially larger in its complexity, in its volume, in its frequency. And so we when we start thinking of big data, we get into, I think, entirely different realms altogether.
Great. Okay. Well, that definitely makes it clear as to the differences. Tom, what's your perspective on what are we talking about when we talk about open data and big data?
Yeah, so I'd largely agree with that. I think there are some examples where big data can be made open and can be useful. So I give a good example would be bin collections. If you are in a home, in a property, and you know what day your bins are collected, that should be open data. I mean, anyone can tell when the bin man's going to come and collect it.
Yeah.
So that's open data. When you look at every property in the whole country and every schedule of bin collections and the weight of each bin collection or the percent that went to recycling, that starts to get quite big in terms of the amount of data. But I would still suggest that it maybe isn't what you call big data, it's just big open data. So the schedule for bin collection is still just open data, and probably, as Doug said, some person created those timetables.
Yeah.
Where we get into interesting places is you can get big data that's open, and an example would be if you had the energy use of every public building every 30 minutes for 10 years.
Mm.
That's now a huge data set, and that requires some techniques that people who have been trained to do things with big data would be comfortable with. It should also be open, and increasingly we're fine with dealing with those huge data sets. And they are, as Doug says, created by a smart box in a home. They're not created by people. The data is just too big for a person to either create or understand.
Right. Okay. I mean, both of you talked a little bit about where the demand for the use of open data, or indeed the concepts behind it, talking about the need to deliver more efficient public services in different forms. Is there a sense that because this data is being collected, that that in itself is creating a momentum to do more things with it? In a sense, it now sits there, it's been generated, and people want to use it. I mean, where's the balance of demand for the open data? Tom, what's your thoughts on that?
So, I mean, I think the fact that the data is being generated, often it's not even being collected. So it's being generated, it's not being collected. Often then, if it is collected, it just sits somewhere. So people feel like they run a service for a public or private body. They feel that the data is probably of value, so they collect it. But then they struggle to figure out what value it might have. So that's where you get to having the value, I think, from open, is saying, we have this data, we've looked at it really carefully, and it's not dangerous. We've made sure that it's not dangerous. Mm-hmm. It doesn't tell you exactly where every person lives and where they go everywhere. So we're going to release it in some anonymized form, and maybe you could tell us what it could be useful for.
I think that's a really interesting point that Tom's made. We refer to open data as if it's a single, consistent, inexorable market or demand for openness, and I think that's not the case. I think there are a couple of things pulling data or pushing data from the outside of councils to external constituents. In some cases, there's a concerned citizen who would like to know what's going on with the park near him or her, or the school system near him or her. In some cases, there's a visionary officer or elected official that's decided to make data open, and that's typically for one of two reasons, either for reasons of transparency, to meet the transparency code, or simply because this is the public's data. Mm. This is the taxpayer's data, and this data should be open, and some elected or appointed officials and officers recognize that and just make a point of publishing data. Or they may say, this data could be more useful in the public hand to help us solve some problems. And so not really publishing for purposes of transparency, but publishing because the skills to apply some data science to that data, and some officers recognize that those skills don't exist inside their councils. And so I believe that there's a component to opening data that comes from cities recognizing that if they publish, then more good things will happen, and that data will be more useful.
Yeah, cities and the city bureaucracies have always used information to needed information in order to deliver public services. So, is this the latest iteration of using information to make decisions, or do we see something genuinely revolutionary or transformative in open data and the benefits and advantages that it offers? Tom, where are we on that?
One of the rules of thumb, and I've never actually proved it with data, but I think it's true, I feel it's true, is that 2/3 of open data gets used by the same place that put it out there.
Right.
So I think that city councils generally, if you want to have the education department talking to the roads works department, talking to the energy department, they'll do a lot of talking about getting out of silos and cross-boundary working and so on and so on. If they just make the data open and they don't have to even talk to each other, then it actually makes it happen.
Right.
So I think that a lot of open data is just progressing the previous data-led methods that governments have used.
Yeah.
I think the new thing that it does is it brings in a lot of private sector interest. So that's both private sector hackers and tinkerers who might look at things, like you might look at your bus stop that's down the road, or you might look at planning permissions near your house. But it also brings in private sector companies who also have a lot of data that might work with public sector data. So for example, the Leeds Data Mill holds all of Yorkshire Water's water use data. So they're a private company, they don't have to release it for any reason. They just felt that they would get value from having that open, having lots of people looking at water use patterns in Yorkshire and seeing whether anything came out of it.
Great. Well, I wanted to move on to that. Doug, spend a few minutes just talking to us about how different places are now engaged and the sort of work that you're more and more involved in, and we'll get into the implications of that. But just give us a sense as to the nature of the stuff that you're currently working on.
I think the most exciting examples of the application of our set of tools and capabilities are with cities that are able to kind of break an old model of doing things, mm-hmm. and replace that with a more modern, a more agile, and a more responsive approach to government. And it's really reassembling a new kind of governing. And I think that's the most exciting thing that we see. And so what that involves is, I think Tom mentioned an interesting dynamic of breaking down silos and addressing issues. And I think if you look across, 100 of our customers around the world, I would say 75 to 80% of them justify the investment in data technology to solve that problem. And they're really, the general inability of governments to innovate at the same kind of pace as the private sector sees has resulted in a worse silo problem in city governments and local authorities than we see in private sector organizations. And so they've justified the investment in terms of staff efficiency, in terms of better decisions based on data, just simply by solving that silo problem. And so for us, I think then those organizations recognize, well, if we see these benefits, think what happens if this data is shared in a very raw, very valuable, very fast way with a greater audience outside of our organization. And then a whole other set of value is delivered as a result of that.
Right.
And so it's the idea of making data that's held in production systems, in local authorities, in city governments, making that data available in real time, available to ordinary people who don't have data science skills, make it available to officers of that government with this ability to analyze that, to share it, to use it in a variety of ways, and then also make that data available through an API for developers to query every single intersection of rows and columns, and sometimes very big and complex and rapidly changing data sets. At the same time you're doing the previous two for residents and for officers, you're doing that for developers. That then is fundamentally rebuilding how governments look at what they do from a data and data collection standpoint, and they're fundamentally more open and transparent as they do it. And so that really is the most exciting part of open data. And as the London Borough of Camden CIO describes this as, we're not opening data, we're rebuilding governing. We're reshaping how we govern. And that to me is exciting as a taxpayer.
So it's that, more to me, than is just the latest iterative offer. It's, there is a promise of something quite fundamentally different using the data.
In the context of the kinds of cuts that we've seen to local authorities, over the last 5 years and looking out another 5 years, there is no other choice for local governments and for cities than to radically transform with an older population that requires more services and budgets going down. How are they going to do that? Well, if they can be more efficient, if they can rebuild the supply chain of what local governments do by using data smarter, as they've done in Camden, and reform government and reshape government around data, well, that's one of the things they can do in this new, very, very difficult and challenging environment that we live in.
Tom, you've already mentioned Yorkshire Water as an example. You talked earlier on about waste and recycling issues associated with that. Is water, waste, energy, transport, are those the sort of classic areas for you?
Yeah, so the classic area, the one that everyone uses and understands best, is transport.
Right.
So I got the train here this morning and I bought my ticket not from the train company. I bought it from a third party who was able to check the prices and the timetables via an API. And so the train company focused on running a train and someone else focused on selling me the ticket. And And then I got the tube across London and I didn't look at a tube map. I looked it up on my phone. So Microsoft told me how to get here. So London Underground focused on running underground trains, which is what they're good at. They didn't focus on providing me with a fancy app, which no one would use. They let Google and Microsoft and Apple do that bit. So in a way, it's about saying, you know, if TfL want a great app, Google, Microsoft and Apple are better at making apps than them, or CityMap or any of these other people. All that those companies need is access to the data. So if you make access to the data available in any avenue, in any sphere of governance or information or providing a service, what I think you'll find, because we've seen it enough times, is that other people who specialise in looking at data and providing solutions will specialise in looking at data and providing solutions. And probably you, who specialises in providing services for a city, can focus on providing services for the city. And the link between the two is the data. And the link between different silos within government is the data. And I do see that really improving efficiency of things, yeah.
There are echoes of the division of labour that Adam Smith identified, specialisation, which allows greater efficiency and much higher productivity as a result of it. You know, you've described it perfectly. People being able to focus on very specific things that they can be very good at. But you talked about the result of that specialisation and division of labour and division of activity producing tangible benefits and gains. Yeah. Are we still waiting to see those? Or do we have now some building evidence that actually we can see how that's translated into better services, however you define it, or cheaper services, or cost savings? Or
I think Tom just described that,
right.
That more efficient future.
Right.
The journeys that he took this morning would not have been as affordable or as easy. I bet he shaved minutes off his journey, and I'll bet he shaved pounds off his budget as well. And I think this is happening across all areas of data in government and in our lives. We see it happening with dozens and dozens of governments and our customers. One example, building inspections are typically carried out in a city by many, many different kinds of departments on different agendas, often on common infrastructure, and testing for similar kinds of things, but electrical inspections, lift inspections, plumbing and water and heating and cooling inspections. There are companies that are now taking published data out of city open data platforms and building the same kind of apps that Tom just described for navigating through the London Tube system for a building owner so that he or she can see everything that's coming up, and at the same time making that data available to plumbers, to lift inspectors, to lift repairmen, to parts suppliers, to the lift industry, all up and down that supply chain forming that individual building can now access this information in much more efficient ways. And so that this is measurable, directly measurable in terms of reductions in cost to the building owner to comply to the important safety standards that apply to his building. And this can be measured in the efficiency of the businesses that provide the maintenance services on the infrastructure in that building. So it's very clear.
To play devil's advocate for a minute, I mean, both of you are, you know, compelling advocates for the virtues and merits of open data. What are the downsides? What are the concerns, in a sense, if you were, you know, the concerns about privacy or concerns about loss of control or ownership? Repercussions because of the information that's made available. I mean, what's the alternative vision about why we should be concerned about open data, and how valid are some of those concerns, Tom?
Well, I think that there are a lot of concerns. I think that they're all valid. So I'll go through some of them, and then I'll say why I don't think they matter at the end.
Right.
So. There's lots of concerns. A big concern that I have would be if we go back to the example that Doug gave about building. So one of the areas that I've worked on open data a lot is to do with building owners. So that's understanding when planning permissions, which are largely open, they need to be a lot easier to understand as open data, but they are open. When people apply for planning permission, you get a lot of people who will use huge amounts of data skills that I never knew they had to suddenly find 700 reasons why a new home shouldn't be built. And this is your number one problem. So people are great at finding this open data, but you have to look at who is able to access that data. And there is a clear bias towards people who are well-educated, have free time. Certain social classes are going to benefit more from having access to that data to make those arguments. I wouldn't deny that. So the reason why I don't think that matters in this case is that you have to always say, what was the alternative? The alternative was making a data-free decision, allowing nothing to happen, and having some hierarchy of well-appointed people make the same decision. And I don't believe that five well-appointed experts making the same decision is any better than 6,000 NIMBYs saying they don't want anything built. I think neither system worked particularly well. I think we're moving in the right direction, and hopefully what we see as open data becomes more widespread and the tools become more powerful is that more and more people in every type of situation gets to have more of an informed say on what they want their cities to be like. So I see the downsides, and there's plenty of other ones, but I always say you have to think, yes, there's a downside, what's the alternative, and is that any better? And the alternative is generally the status quo, and I almost always see that it is no better, and in fact is quite clearly worse.
So the, you know, this issue there around, you know, moving away from a paternalistic perspective where decisions are made on behalf of people, and you know, there's questions about that. There's obviously issues around access to the democracy element to being able to get hold of the information and understand it as well. I suppose there's issues around privacy.
And, I think that's the potential for downside.
Yeah.
Obviously, and I think the ODI has done.
That's the Open Data Institute.
Open Data Institute has for the past 3 years done a great job at laying out the basic guidelines towards what can and should be published with a specific sensitivity towards privacy, and even if sensitive information is not explicitly released, can it be assumed, or can different data types or sets be aggregated to come up with sensitive data? And I think there's some very good work that's been done to lay down the guidelines there. And I think open is the key word in determining whether data should be released or not. And if common sense is applied, you know, this to me is the single concern in answering your question is, you know, if data that's not supposed to be open gets released. Well, you know, it's far more likely that that information is going to be on somebody's laptop that gets left on a train seat, that gets left on somebody's USB thumb drive after a presentation.
Yeah. If I gave a specific example on that, then I generally don't work with any data that has a name on it. If it has a name on it, then I want that name off before I
even... An individual's name, you mean? An organization's name, you know, something that is clearly identifiable with
I would say on the 300 customers that our company has worldwide, I can only remember seeing one or two data sets that have individual names. The only exception being occasionally our customers, local governments primarily, will publish some data related to elected officials or officers, and that has to be published, and that's fine. But I can count on one hand across all of those other customers. You're absolutely right.
The key here is that the easy targets, so the places where we get real impact from open data, are often in really boring areas. We don't need to know where someone walks around the city every day. You know, we need to know when the buses run. So we need to know how many people in total take a bus. We don't need to know this one person took this bus a certain place. We need to know about how many people go in certain directions. So I think that We're already very good at protecting privacy in the public realm. What I would challenge people to is how well they protect their own privacy in the when they use private services. So, for example, I could check on Google Maps now every cafe and pub around this area when it's busy. So they have that new information. That's because people let them track and report locations. I could go and ask Uber where people travel around this city, and people have happily chosen to use those services, not always in the complete knowledge, but kind of in the knowledge that that exists.
Yeah.
And what we're doing, my fear is that if we're scared of having open data in even these safe, anonymized ways, if we step back from it, we're going to end up with private companies providing a lot of the great data opportunities. So, I mean, a really good example that I'd give is that in most UK cities, we don't know who uses the buses and we don't know where they go. But Uber know in every UK city where people go. So that's, you know, that's, I think, an issue about who owns the data that we've created. Because we could say no to having our data, even safely processed and anonymized, used by public bodies, we've said no. But when we make a decision in the private realm, we just choose the cheapest option and the most easy service and the best service. So I think that there is, we have to hold public bodies who are working with data to a really high standard. And what I see is that they meet that high standard.
Yeah.
Overwhelmingly, they meet that high standard. But I think we also have to be realistic that we choose services that are very data heavy. And we enjoy the services that they provide, and yet we would never allow the public sector to do anything like that with our data. So where we have the chance to say no, we say no.
Yes.
And where we have the option of a great service, we pick the great service. And my worry is then that all of the data ends up being private.
We definitely apply different standards to different, and I think one of the interesting points you make there is we're prepared almost to trade privacy in the private sector because of the, you know, the enjoyment factor. We prepare to give away
convenience or enjoyment.
Whereas in the public sector, I think we feel that, or we're always more nervous that this will be used to control, to watch, to, you know, to keep an eye on, to track, and actually the enjoyment we get or the utility we get from that is somehow less. But it's a very interesting point. I want to move on to just get your reflections on, I suppose, one on the UK at a macro level and how, where it sits against other countries in this agenda. You know, are we leading? Are we followers? Are we laggards? But also, I think then, you know, given that you work with lots of different places, you know, do you see quite a differentiated approach that different places are, you know, are taking? And clearly, some are doing some fantastic things, but is that, are those rare exceptions, or are they part of the mainstream? So Doug, give us a sense as to where at the UK level, the country level, we sit as a leader, laggard, or following in the pack.
Yeah, it's an interesting and nuanced question, Andrew. I think the UK has led in transparency for a variety of reasons for the last 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. And that's exciting. As a resident, I'm proud of that initiative. And yet, I think other countries are leading in this challenge and meeting this challenge to revolutionize government through data.
Right.
And through opening the borders to government, to the kind of crowdsourcing of solutions that Tom mentioned, to in ways that improve public service delivery and reduce cost and reallocate resources into more efficient ways of delivering all of the hard things that governments have to do. And I find the UK behind in that area.
Yeah, so I'd agree with Doug broadly. I think the Open Data Institute publish a ranking of transparency and governance, or open data, transparency and governance, and the UK does really well. And I think that there are a lot of reasons. I think there's been quite good cross-party agreement on that. So Chianwura, who is was at Ofgem, she led a lot of really great stuff early on with saying, I want open data on broadband access. And then she was high up in the Labour Party's thinking, I'm pretty sure about that. And so when the Conservative Party were doing it, they were broadly like, yeah, we agree with this and we have someone who knows, and things progressed well. I think another advantage that the UK has had in opening up its data is that we already held it in one place. So we often talk about the downsides, and me especially talk about the downsides of UK centralisation.
You're not alone in that respect, yeah. As you well know, Tom.
But there are some upsides, and one of them is that if everything is in one place, it's a lot easier to have a meeting and agree that all the data can be open.
Yeah.
What's then really difficult is to get people interested, and people are inherently interested in where they live,
yeah.
Not in the lump of data. They want they want answers to problems, and they want that to happen where they live and where they're interested in. And the centralized system is not a good way to generate that activity. So I think what we have in the UK is a big head start, because we were able to tell national bodies to get this data out. And I think we did really well at it. But we risk falling behind at the application of it if we don't take the applications to where people are and where they're interested and what they're doing.
Okay.
And that's the downside, yeah, of the centralization that let us lead in the first place.
There's an interesting dynamic here that when governments release data, valuable data, and interested residents, citizen data scientists, journalists see that data and do more with it, that impels governments to release more data and begin to, you know, to engage their citizens and be more open and also be more efficient and deliver more. And so there's an interesting dynamic there. And we see that fairly regularly. What's been interesting, I think, you know, the statutory requirement to publish a fairly limited number of data sets here in the UK allowed some governments to put a check in the box that we've met our open statutory requirements, and really that's it.
Right.
And I think that taking a deeper look at the kind of transformation that's possible through data is what we really need to do. And I think that is happening in an evolutionary way. And it's just super exciting to see cities and local authorities across the UK move into that area.
Okay. Tom, how do we push this agenda on? How do we, you know, how do we make sure our cities are at the forefront of this emerging revolution?
It's a really tough challenge at the minute, because I passionately believe that it has to be cities who lead on this, and yet cities have decreasing access to any money to lead on it with. So we're in a tough spot where central government still seems to have some money to fund the innovation in this.
Does that mean it's an expensive process in order to do it, or is there an upfront cost that needs to be borne? Or
no, I think you can do this stuff at really low cost.
Right.
The political cost of doing it at really low cost can be quite challenging.
Right.
So when you are firing social workers or care workers, even if the cost of you running some open data project is one member of staff, that is obviously, to people who are losing services, one member of staff too many.
Yeah.
So it becomes a question of investment in the future versus providing services, which might be in a really tough spot now. Generally, I think opening the data up doesn't cost much money.
Right.
So the data's there. If the culture and the willingness is there in the organisation, then it doesn't cost any extra money to open it up. And I think that we will see quite a lot of activity come out of just having the data open. In order to push and prime more activity, I think that the kind of devolution deals that we have are absolutely essential for this. So I think Scotland does quite well on open data. I think that's because they're able to set aside some discretionary money to do it from a big pot.
Yeah.
I think that in Leeds we've done really well in open data, but it's largely due to what Doug mentioned earlier, a few visionary people who have pushed the agenda.
Right.
In a way it could have been anywhere else, it could just be luck. I think that if we want to push it forward, we need to allow certain cities to decide that it wants to be what they're really good at, to be a business that they want to develop in their cities. And what we'll find quite quickly, I think, is that once some local specialism develops, and there's already quite a lot in certain places, so Bath, Bristol, Leeds, all quite good at doing stuff with this, I think that other places nearby will copy them.
Great.
So a good example as well would be Trafford Council.
Mm-hmm.
They have a great data and open data analysis unit within the council. It would be great if the whole of Greater Manchester just copied that.
Mm.
And I think that that's how it will work, and that's how it will happen.
Yeah.
But we need to have the possibility for Greater Manchester Council to say, here's three salaries to copy
to really
what's happening
in Trafford. Yeah, it's a good point.
That's an example.
Yeah. So as we begin to draw to a close, I want to get your perspectives. So you're both working with places that are trying to do this, thinking about this. Reflecting on your experiences, and start with you, Doug. I mean, what would be your practical advice to, you know, to places that are thinking about how they engage in the open data agenda? I mean, where do they start? What are the things that they ought to be thinking about?
I think it's easy to get caught up in very large, wide-ranging concepts and programs when we think about big data and open data. My advice is to start simple. Start with one piece of data, one data set, and a problem. What's a particular challenge or what's a particular an opportunity in a local area? I don't want to say a within a specific authority or city or any border, but find a problem and find some data, and maybe just one problem and one piece of data, and adopt the mantra of, you know, one of the most successful open data programs in the UK, Bath Hacked, is a group of citizens, and their first challenge to each other and to themselves is to be useful. And I think if we focus on things, be useful, and then iterate, you know, there is no ultimate perfect solution to these problems. Let's focus on building things quickly that solve problems that are useful, and then let's do it again. And then I think momentum will grow quite quickly. And you can avoid the challenge of trying to solve all the problems that can burden any of the best intentions.
I like that. Be useful. It's a good mantra. It applies to so many things, but be useful is a nice one. Tom, what's the practical advice that we can be offering places about how they start on the open data journey?
Yeah, I mean, I think Doug's point's really good. I would phrase it as perfect really is the enemy of good in open data. So the only thing that a data owner needs to endlessly worry about is safety. So if their data is not useful, it didn't cost them anything to put it to the public, just put it up. And you might not think it's useful, you might think the format's awful, you might think that no one will use it.
Hmm.
But, you know, over and over again, we've seen that people do use it. So, I mean, the Bath Hacks example that Doug gave was like, they put up the live readings for parking spaces. So previously, this was a function of the city to have boards telling you where you could park in the city. They already provide those boards, so why put it up? You know, well, someone went and built an app, and you can download it, and you can see before you set off where you're going to park in Bath now.
Mm.
So the data format may not have been great, but there's a lot of systems now, a lot of clever people who do data work who will fix your data format for you, or who next time you release it in 3 months will give you five tips and five pointers of how you could do it better. the big obstacle is just deciding as a culture within the data owning organization, whether it's public sector or private sector, that they are going to release the data. And I would just say to all of them, consider what value you're getting from the data now. It's almost always nothing. Almost always it's sat around not doing much. And now consider what you're losing by opening it. And if you're not getting any value from it now, give it a try, because I am really confident that 9 times out of 10 you'll get a huge amount of value back, and you won't have decided or figured out what it was going to be in 50 meetings. It'll just happen. And I think people are continually amazed by what comes out of listening.
That example that Tom's given in Bath is a great one, because the chief information officer or the IT department in Bath and Northeast Somerset probably didn't say, hey, we need an app that shows live parking data on somebody's phone. Well, they probably didn't say that. They probably don't have user experience people to design the app, or coders to develop for the app, or the resources to pay those kinds of people. But by following the recommendations that Tom just outlined and publish the data that might have been sitting around and not that useful, it ends up being built by the community into something that's very useful.
Yeah. I want to close by getting both your thoughts on the future, and optimistic or pessimistic, but also how you see the open data agenda evolving over the next 5 or 10 years.
I am interested in Tom's perspective. I'll offer one perspective. You know, increasingly residents will require their interaction with their local authorities and other government bodies through their phones. And so we will see the digital transformation of government that will be enabled by very powerful combinations of technologies, speaking through open data application programming interfaces or APIs that will allow people to build citizen services the way that this generation will require that they be consumed and delivered and consumed on their telephones. And so I see that as the future, a whole new kinds of combinations of information services delivered to residents on phones.
Yeah, so generally my outlook is positive. There are going to be problems. So funding is going to be a big problem for all of this. Some cities will make a difficult political decision to kickstart some action with open data. As I said, it's a small amount of money, but it is still money that came from somewhere else. And as budgets get cut, that's going to be the tough part. And the biggest risk, I think, so still staying really positive, I think it's going to happen, and I think we'll overcome these risks. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest risk that we have in Europe is kind of techno-panics type stuff, where our gut response immediately to anything is no, we shouldn't do this. This is technological, I'm not comfortable with it, we shouldn't do it. And we risk just falling behind other places who will develop the solutions that we then choose to use. So we'll have lost control of the solutions that we increasingly rely on. And I think that would be bad for the economies in cities in the UK and in Europe, but I think it would be bad for people as well, because the services that are provided based on open data, so I think the open data is going to come out. I think we agree the transparency is good and it will happen faster or slower.
Yeah.
But the services that are going to be designed on them should ideally be designed quite close to where people use them. So a great example that I have is that all of the weather apps on all of our phones use open data about weather. And all of them tell me that every day in Manchester, Birmingham or Leeds is going to be rainy. Well, it's only rainy for 30 minutes, but the guy who designed it in California thinks that 30 minutes of rain is wet. Well, I think it's a gorgeous day. So we have to avoid that.
Context is everything.
Context is everything.
Yeah. Context is everything. It always is. Great. My guests this month have been Tom Forth and Doug McLeod. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by the Centre for Cities. We're an independent, non-partisan think tank dedicated to understanding and improving city economies. For more on our research and events programme, including our extensive back catalogue, please visit our website, centreforcities.org.